Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
So the first Thanksgiving story is begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace.
As the nation marks Thanksgiving, we speak to the Indigenous scholar and activist Nick Estes on settler colonialism and continuing Indigenous resistance. Then, the dissenters. Two former top officials, Craig McIver at the United Nations and Josh Paul at the State Department. They both resigned from their jobs to protest the Israeli bombardment of Gaza.
I decided to resign for three reasons, the first and most pressing of which is the very, I believe, uncontroversial fact that U.S.-provided arms should not be used to massacre civilians, should not be used to result in massive civilian casualties, and that is what we are seeing in Gaza.
The hardest part of proving genocide has been proven for us with these very open statements of genocidal intent by Israeli officials, including the prime minister and the president and senior cabinet ministers and military officials.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this special broadcast, we begin the show with the Indigenous scholar and activist Nick Estes, co-founder of the Indigenous resistance group The Red Nation and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. His books include Our History is the Future, which tells the history of Indigenous resistance over two centuries, offering a roadmap for collective liberation and a guide to fighting life-threatening climate change. Estes centers this history in the historic fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. I asked him to talk about the two Thanksgiving stories he writes about at the beginning of his book.
So the first Thanksgiving story is begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace. And then I begin with another story of a prayer march that we led in the Bismarck Mall in Bismarck, North Dakota, to kind of bring attention to the Standing Rock struggle during a Black Friday shopping event, which was met by police armed with AR-15s, who then began punching and kicking water protectors who were holding a prayer in the Bismarck Mall. And I thought it was a really kind of jarring sort of contrast between the past and the present, to say that while there are sort of differences between the massacre of Pequots in Massachusetts to the contemporary sort of fight against an oil pipeline, nonetheless, you know, Bismarck, North Dakota is a 90% white community that originally the Dakota Access Pipeline was supposed to go upriver from, but then was rerouted downriver to disproportionately affect the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And disproportionate is the language that the Army Corps of Engineers use, as if there's ever a proportionate risk to environmental issues and water contamination. So at this particular moment, there weren't any actions that were happening in the camps, and it was largely at a standstill. And I think at that Thanksgiving weekend, there was an un-Thanksgiving feast that was held in the camps, and it was actually the highest point of the camps themselves, in the sense that there were the most sort of water protectors had showed up. So I thought it was a good kind of contrast to show that this history, you know, is a continuing history of genocide, of settler colonialism, and basically the founding myths of this country.
Your book's last words are, we're challenged not just to imagine, but to demand the emancipation of Earth from capital. For the Earth to live, capitalism must die. Explain.
So that line is part of, you know, this longer section on liberation. And I think when we think about climate change, oftentimes the question of climate change really centers on market-driven solutions, such as, you know, green capitalism, and how do we create markets that sort of incentivize transition to sustainable economies, right? And I think really what we're kind of like beating around the bushes is that it's the system of capitalism that led us into this economic crisis to begin with. It's the sort of designation of certain populations in certain territories as disposable that has led us into our current epoch of global climate change. And so when we talk about who's going to bear the most burden when we transition, you know, out of the carbon economy, it most likely is going to be those populations that have historically been colonized. You know, and you know what's happening in Southeast Africa is a perfect example of why we need to transition away from not just the carbon economy, but capitalist economies in general. Because if we look at the history of how Africa has been a resource colony for Europe and for North America, we can look internally in the United States and understand that indigenous nations continue to serve as resource colonies for the United States, whether it's the Navajo Nation, where I'm living right now, that is producing oil and coal to generate electricity for the Southwest region, or whether it's the Fort Berthold Reservation up in North Dakota that is, you know, the ground zero for oil and gas development in the Bakken region. We have to understand that indigenous nations have largely been turned into resource colonies and sites of sacrifice for not just the United States, but for the oil and gas industry. And so we need to not just think beyond climate change and putting carbon into the atmosphere, but we actually need to think about the system, the social system, right, that created those conditions in the first place. And so capitalism is fundamentally a social relation. It's a profit-driven system, whereas indigenous sort of ways of relating is one about reciprocity and mutual sort of respect, not just with the human, but also with the non-human world. And we're undergoing, you know, the sixth massive extinction event, which is caused by not just climate change, but is caused by capitalist sort of systems and the profit-driven sort of motive of our current economic and social system.
Nick Estes, you focus on seven historical moments of resistance in your new book, Our History is the Future. You say they form a historical roadmap for collective liberation. How did you choose these histories? Just quickly take us through them.
Sure. So I begin at the camps. I begin in the present, you know, at Standing Rock, and then I go to the fur trade with the first U.S. invasion, which was Lewis and Clark, who came through, who trespassed through our territory and were stopped by our leadership. And then I go through the Indian Wars of the 19th century and the Buffalo Genocide, and then I go into talking about the damming of the Missouri River in the mid 20th century, and then looking at red power in the 1960s and the 1970s, and how all of these indigenous people who were relocated because their lands were flooded by these dams eventually found themselves and created sort of the modern indigenous movement known as Red Power, and then going back and ending actually at Standing Rock in 1974 with the creation of the International Indian Treaty Council, which really coalesced these generations of indigenous resistance and took the treaties, the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, to the world and to the United Nations. And to do that, they looked to Palestinians. They looked to the South African anti-apartheid movement, who provided the mechanisms for recognition of indigenous rights at the United Nations. And that all resulted over four decades in the touchstone document, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was passed by the UN in 2007. And so in many ways, when we look at Standing Rock and we go down Flag Row and we see the hundreds of tribal nation flags that were represented in 2016 and 2017, we also saw the Palestinian flag that was there, kind of hearkening back to that international solidarity with movements of the global south, and specifically our Palestinian relatives, who today are still facing, much like us, are still facing the brunt and the brutality of settler colonialism, whether it's the United States recognizing the annexation of the Golan Heights, or whether it's here in North America and the continued dispossession of indigenous territory and rights. We can see that settler colonialism in Israel or in Palestine is really an extension of settler colonialism in North America. And then I end, with back at the camps and looking at how these camps really provided, I actually look at a physical map that was handed out to water protectors who came to the camp. And on that map, there was, where to find food, where to find the clinics, right? And where to find the security and all the camps that were represented at the at Standing Rock. And to me, that provided, a kind of interesting parallel to the world that surrounded the camps, which was 92 different law enforcement jurisdictions. You had the North Dakota National Guard, the world of cops, the world of the militarized sort of police state. And in the camps themselves, you had sort of the primordial sort of beginnings of what a world premised on indigenous justice might look like. And in that world, everyone got free food. There was a place for everyone, the housing, obviously was transient housing and teepees and things like that. But then also there was health clinics to provide health care, alternative forms of health care to everyone. And so if we look at that, it's housing, education, all for free, right? A strong sense of community. And for a short time, there was free education at the camps, right? Those are things that most poor communities in the United States don't have access to, and especially reservation communities. But given the opportunity to create a new world in that camp centered on indigenous justice and treaty rights, society organized itself according to need and not to profit. And so where there was, the world of settlers, settler colonialism that surrounded us, there was the world of indigenous justice that existed for a brief moment in time. And in that world, instead of doing to settler society what they did to us, genociding, removing, excluding, there's a capaciousness to indigenous resistance movements that welcomes in non-indigenous peoples into our struggle, because that's our primary strength, is one of relationality, one of making kin, right?
Nick Estes, indigenous scholar and activist, speaking in 2019. His books include Our History is the Future. He's co-founder of the indigenous resistance group, the Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. When we come back, international human rights lawyer Craig McIver. He recently resigned as director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, accusing the UN of failing to address what he calls a textbook case of genocide unfolding in Gaza.
Oh, hey,
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this holiday special, we spend the rest of the hour with the dissenters. Two top officials, Craig McKeiber at the United Nations and Josh Paul at the State Department, they both recently resigned from their jobs to protest the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. We begin with Craig McKeiber, longtime international human rights lawyer who served as director of the New York office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. He'd worked at the United Nations since 1992 and lived in Gaza in the 1990s. He recently resigned his post and accused the United Nations of failing to address what he calls a textbook case of genocide unfolding in Gaza. In a letter addressed to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, Craig McKeiber wrote, quote, "In Gaza, civilian homes, schools, churches, mosques, and medical institutions are wantonly attacked as thousands of civilians are massacred. In the West Bank, including occupied Jerusalem, homes are seized and reassigned based entirely on race, and violent settler pogroms are accompanied by Israeli military units. Across the land, apartheid rules," McKeiber said. Craig McKeiber went on to write, "What's more, the governments of the United States, United Kingdom, and much of Europe are wholly complicit in the horrific assault. Not only are these governments refusing to meet their treaty obligations to ensure respect for the Geneva Conventions, but they're in fact actively arming the assault, providing economic and intelligence support, and giving political and diplomatic cover for Israel's atrocities," unquote. I spoke to Craig McKeiber on November 1st, a day after he stopped working at the United Nations. I asked him to talk about why he resigned.
Well, I originally registered my concerns in writing to the High Commissioner in March, as you heard from that statement, in the wake of a wave of human rights violations on the West Bank, including the pogrom in Hawara at that time. And at that time, I complained really about what I saw as a trepidatious response by many in the United Nations and an effort to try to silence some of the human rights critique of UN officials, including myself. I admit to feeling a great deal of frustration and at that moment indicating that I would be resigning from the UN effective this month. So, of course, the situation got much worse since then, which is why I was, particularly the events in Gaza, which is why I was compelled to write this latest letter to the High Commissioner to put on record my very serious concerns about how we were failing to address the unfolding events in the occupied territories.
What do you think the United Nations, the United States, the West, UK should be doing right now?
Well, I think there is an obligation on the part of all member states of the United Nations, including those states in the West, to respond in accordance with their obligations under international law, including international humanitarian law. My central point in the most recent letter was that we had effectively left international law behind when the international community embraced the Oslo process, which sort of raised up notions of political expediency above the requirements of international law. And that was a real loss for human rights in Palestine. I think there is an obligation on the part of all states, not just to respect international humanitarian law and international human rights law, but under the Geneva Conventions to ensure respect. And it's clear that many states, including the United States itself, have not only are not only in breach of their obligation to ensure respect vis-a-vis those states over which they have influence, in this case, Israel, but have been actively complicit, actively engaged in arming and diplomatic cover, in political support, intelligence support, and so on. That is a breach of international humanitarian law. We need the opposite of that. We need all states, members of the United Nations, to use whatever influence they have to ensure an end to these attacks on civilians in Gaza, to ensure as well accountability for the perpetrators, redress for the victims, protection for the vulnerable there. It's interesting, Amy, we have a formula at the United Nations that is applied to virtually every other conflict situation. But when it comes to the situation in Israel and Palestine, there's a different set of rules, apparently. And that's, I think, a big source of my frustration. Where is the transitional justice process? Where is the UN protection force to protect all civilians? Where is the tribunal for accountability? Where is the action on the part of the Security Council, the only mechanism in the United Nations that has enforcement to ensure protection in the occupied territories? Obviously, every effort in the Security Council is vetoed by the United States itself, and further indication of the kind of complicity about which I am referring. And I think the other thing that needs to happen in the international community is that we have to abandon the failed paradigms of the past on a political level and get back to the roots, which is international law, international human rights. What has happened in the context of the so-called Oslo process, the two-state solution, the UN quartet, is that they have acted effectively as a smokescreen behind which we have seen further and worsening dispossession of Palestinians, massive atrocities such as those as we are witnessing now, the loss of homes and land, further settlement activity. You know, it's an open secret inside the halls of the United Nations that the so-called two-state solution is effectively impossible now. There's nothing left for a sustainable state for the Palestinian people, and takes no account of the fundamental human rights of the Palestinian people. The new paradigm has to be one based upon equality of all people there, equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. And that needs to be the new approach. And I think as well, you know, it's interesting that this year we are commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights adopted in 1948. That same year, the Nakba occurred in Palestine and apartheid was adopted in South Africa. We have seen, because of a consistent international law and international human rights approach in the UN and the international community, that apartheid in South Africa fell. We did not take the same approach in Palestine. We've deferred to these political processes. And as a result, not only have we not seen an end to the oppression of the Palestinian people, we've seen a continuing worsening of the situation.
So you're a longtime human rights lawyer. I want you to respond. I played this already for Yusuf Hamash in Gaza right now, in Khan Yunis, to respond. But I'd like you to respond to it as well. After Israel's attack on Jabalia yesterday, the IDF spokesperson, Israeli Defense Force spokesperson, Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht, appeared on CNN and was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer.
But you know that there are a lot of refugees, a lot of innocent civilians, men, women, and children in that refugee camp as well, right?
This is the tragedy of war, Wolf. I mean, we, as you know, we've been saying for days, move south. Civilians are not involved with Hamas. Please move south.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a little bit more information. You knew there were civilians there. You knew there were refugees, all sorts of refugees, but you decided to still drop a bomb on that refugee camp attempting to kill the Hamas commander. By the way, was he killed?
I can't confirm yet. There'll be more updated. Yes, we know that he was killed. About the civilians there, we're doing everything we can to minimize.
So he's saying they're doing everything they can to minimize. He's talking about Ibrahim Biari, whom it identified, Israel's identified as Hamas's commander of the Jabalia Center Battalion, saying he was killed in those recent strikes. Can you respond to every aspect of what he said? They were trying to get a high-value target, as they put it, and they are not trying to kill civilians.
Well, I think what's important in that interview is that is another of many indications of intent on the part of Israeli authorities that will be very important in a court of law. He has said very openly that they knew of the concentrations of civilians there, and yet, in violation of the principle of distinction in international humanitarian law, and on the pretext of killing one combatant, wiped out the better part of an entire refugee camp, densely populated refugee camp. And I think what's been interesting in this war is the very open statement of intents. I referred in my letter to the case for genocide, which is happening now. And, you know, genocide is a very politicized term often abused. But in this case, the hardest part of proving genocide has been proven for us with these very open statements of genocidal intent by Israeli officials, including the prime minister and the president and senior cabinet ministers and military officials, who in their public statements have indicated very clearly their intention not to distinguish between civilians and combatants and to carry out the kinds of wholesale slaughter that we are witnessing in Gaza. That is not a justification in international law, saying that there was a combatant there for that very disproportionate use of firepower against what was a civilian target. And that's what we've been seeing in all of Gaza, from the north to the south. The other thing is this claim that, well, we told them to move south, and therefore we can kill everybody who didn't move. This is an extremely dangerous and unlawful tactic that is being used. First, because we know that evacuations in Gaza in the best of times, in this densely populated small territory with 2.3 million civilians crowded in with very limited infrastructure, is a huge challenge. But most of Gaza has been bombed into rubble. It is just not physically possible for civilians to move en masse in the ways that Israel has required them to do so. And we know, already well documented, that when they do so, they're still subjected to bombings even in the south of the Gaza Strip. So all of this, it seems to me, is evidence of intent and a prima facie case for violations of the laws of war.
Israel's called for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to resign after he said Hamas's October 7th attack did not happen in a vacuum. This is Israel's UN ambassador, Gilad Erdan.
Mr. Secretary General, the UN was established to prevent atrocities, to prevent such atrocities like the barbaric atrocities that Hamas committed. But the UN is failing. The UN is failing, and you, Mr. Secretary General, have lost all morality and impartiality. Because when you say those terrible words that these heinous attacks did not happen in a vacuum, you are tolerating terrorism. And by tolerating terrorism, you are justifying terrorism.
That's Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Craig McIver. Your response?
Well, of course, you can imagine why the ambassador would want to start the clock only in October and to ignore the decades upon decades of persecution against the Palestinian people in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, inside Israel proper. But that is not the kind of assessment that leads to peace or leads to an improved situation on the ground. The Secretary General was doing his job. He had condemned the loss of civilian life in the Hamas attack, and he also criticized not just what Israel was doing in Gaza, but all of the events that have led up to this situation. And that's what I mean by a need to break from the failed paradigm of the past. We really need to get into something that says that human beings are entitled to human rights under international law, and that the duty of the international community is to ensure protection for all under the rule of law, but also accountability for perpetrators and redress for victims. So I am not surprised at that statement. We've seen a lot of extreme statements from that particular ambassador, a lot of theater as well. I don't think we should allow it to distract us to what's happening on the ground, which is the wholesale loss of life of innocent civilians in their thousands, including thousands of children in the Gaza Strip, and the need to get to an immediate ceasefire and then to shift into a new approach that will prevent this from happening again and again and again.
I'm wondering about the role of Karim Khan.